Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. It's not a new class, but it is a new topic, comparatively speaking. Environmental ethics is being taught this fall semester by Dr. Phil Oliver, professor of philosophy here at MTSU. Can you be green and political at the same time? And how political do you need to be in order to convince everybody else to be greener? We'll ask Phil that, and we'll ask him a lot more after we have a few clean and green words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. MTSU is now one of 105 universities in the country to gain full membership with the Oak Ridge Associated Universities. Dr. Michael Allen, Dean of the College of Graduate Studies, says the move gives MTSU faculty and students a chance to land members-only grants and internships and provides a gateway to laboratory research at federal facilities. And there's still time to register girls to attend the 2012 MTSU Expanding Your Horizons in Science and Mathematics Conference. The deadline is Monday, September 3rd, that's Labor Day. The conference will be held Saturday, September 22nd on the MTSU campus. EYH is a hands-on math and science event for 5th through 8th grade girls and high school girls. For MTSU News at any time, go to mtsunews.com.
Dr. Phil Oliver, welcome back, Phil. It's been a long time since we've spoken last. I think it was about a year ago we talked about another class you were doing.
That's right. It's great to be back.
You said you've taught environmental ethics before. How long has this class actually been in existence here?
I was tallying up those classes the other day, making a list of all of the books I've used, and it's a pretty long list. I find that I've used different texts every time I've taught it, and I've taught it pretty much on a two-year rotation, going back almost 10 years, I think.
And yet still, our environmental consciousness is not really that old in terms of the span of history. How do we encourage one another to be more environmentally aware? Because, as you know, in the 60s, environmentalism was associated with hippies and radicals and was disdained by the establishment.
Disdained by some of the establishment. I find, as I research the topic of environmentalism from the angle of activism, that a lot of the old flakes, so-called, who sort of sponsored the original Earth Day, have come to be regarded as the new environmental establishment now. People, for instance, over the summer, I dug out, actually I found a used copy of The Greening of America, which was sort of a manifesto for its time in the late 60s. Maybe it came out right around the time of Earth Day in 1970. And Charles Reich was pretty radical seeming, and yet the ground was sort of ripe for that at the time. It became a bestseller. And when you read it now, I think some of us anyway are going to be struck, if you go back to reread it, you're going to be struck by how timely it is in a lot of ways. In other ways, it's dated. It's very much a product of its time. He talks about consciousness one and consciousness two, and what we're trying to get to is consciousness three, which is the place at which we begin to appreciate that we all need to be green and rise above politics in order to save the planet, save the ecosystem. To a space alien coming here and observing, the summer that we've just undergone, in June and July, breaking records all over the country and the planet in terms of heat, and then extremes of weather that are thought to be related to the changing climate, the warming climate. It seems as though it would be a no-brainer for most of us to think we need to rise above petty politics and partisanship and deal with the issues surrounding this environmental problem. And yet, too many of us, I'm afraid, are still stuck in the politics that keep us from doing that. The evidence is really pretty strong, but there's a strong lobby pushing in the other direction, and so that's what we're up against as we try to sort of raise, to speak the language of the Greening of America, to raise everybody's consciousness about this issue.
And, of course, the industrialist would say, for example, if you have a smokestack industry, that it cost money in order to install scrubbers in the smokestacks, as right. would be required by the EPA. We also know that landfills historically seem to be placed in areas where there are poor, low-income people, usually minority populations, because they don't have enough political clout to say, not in my backyard.
Right, right. And so there are people who are sort of hostage to other issues in our social life that need to be taken on. And this, by the way, maybe would be a good place to say that the text that we're going to start with in this course is called Blessed Unrest. It is an environmental text, but it's also it's an attempt to suggest that there are important dots to connect between environmentalism and issues broadly called social justice issues, who's not being adequately represented, who among the vulnerable in our society are being taken advantage of by those who have the resources, the money, and the political ability to sway events and to get those toxins dumped in somebody else's backyard.
The political scientist might call the overarching philosophy communitarianism. That is, we're all in this together. Therefore, right. We must all take care of each other's air, take care of each other's water, take care of each other's land.
That's right. And that's also a political statement these days at a time when the Tea Party is very prominent and suggesting that what we need is a return to good old rugged individualism, and never mind communitarianism. I actually think that the best wisdom on this topic comes from a very indigenous source, the Native Americans and indigenous peoples generally around the world, who insist that we are all related one to another and to nature itself, and we're all part of nature and need to respect that, respect it, and respect ourselves in the process.
Hold that thought. I'm going to get you to expound on that and take it in a slightly different direction. When we come back, this is MTSU on the Record.
Expanding Your Horizons is an annual hands-on science and math conference for middle and high school girls. EYH enables girls to investigate careers in science and math, and to talk with female leaders in those fields that are so essential to our nation's future. EYH also provides the girls with fun, hands-on activities and allows them to meet girls with similar interests. I'm Dr. Judith Iriarte-Gross, EYH Director.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking with Dr. Phil Oliver, MTSU philosophy professor, about his upcoming fall course, Environmental Ethics. You were talking about the Native American approach. Of course, their feeling about nature was very much wrapped up in their spirituality, yes. their religion, their faith, if you will. But environmental ethics are not necessarily incompatible with other religions around the world, are they? I mean, Christianity, one can quote the passages in the Bible which God is essentially calling on man to be a good steward mm-hmm. of the resources with which God has entrusted him, right?
Sure. I think there are resources in the Judeo-Christian tradition, and certainly in Asian traditions, and in the Native American tradition that I was speaking of, resources that we can draw on to appreciate that we are all in it together, and that we do have a common responsibility to one another end of the earth, and that there's nothing squishy or new agey about that perspective at all, that it makes perfect sense. It's really ancient wisdom, timeless ancient wisdom. That's why, by the way, the last time I did environmental ethics, we did the course it was called Environmental Ethics and Native Wisdom, and we pulled on those very kinds of resources to try to understand that perspective, how best to take care of the planet while also realizing that it's not just something we're doing for it or for selfish reasons, but because it's a fundamental ethical and spiritual precept that we're part of the planet, it's part of us, we need to take care of it.
If I remember correctly, it wasn't John Muir, the founding father of the Sierra Club, a devout Presbyterian, and did his appreciation of conservation and love of the land not stem from his devout faith?
Yes, I've actually been, interesting you would say that, I've been reading some of John Muir lately, sort of in preparation for this course, and I'm intrigued by him, intrigued by his certainly his Presbyterian upbringing and how he came to join that with a more, I'll say, environmental perspective, even a secular environmental perspective. He says things that are not hostile to anyone's religious faith, really, but which suggests that nature itself already embodies a strong sense of wonder, a sense of spirituality. We don't need to go to any of the humanly contrived faith traditions. We can simply notice ourselves in nature, notice the wonder, as he said when he was out at Yosemite or in the Sierras, just notice the grandeur, the wonder of it, and feel yourself a part of all that. And out of that then flows not just that sense of, wow, here I am in nature, but the sense that there is a responsibility incumbent upon all of us who are alive at this moment to make sure that it continues, that it remains sustainable, modern buzzword for future generations. And that could be a spiritual attitude that's not certainly not reducible to or necessarily even associated with any particular world faith tradition, but it's perfectly compatible, as you say, with just about any of the good ones.
Going into the pulpit on Sunday, one might hear all kinds of self-help pep rally kinds of sermons. We might hear all kinds of hellfire and damnation sermons about sin and adultery and sex. But do we really hear preachers preach sermons about being good stewards of God's resources anymore?
Right. Can't quite speak to that, but I will say that this reminds me of the atheist biologist E.O. Wilson, who wrote a book called The Creation a few years ago. It was addressed very forthrightly from the standpoint of an atheist. He is and identifies himself in that work and elsewhere as an atheist. And he says, I'm addressing myself to pastors from the Baptist faith that I'm familiar with from my childhood in Alabama, and inviting them, or really appealing to them, to recognize, indeed, as we were saying, that we're all in this together, that we all have a common responsibility for the earth, whether we're atheists, agnostics, Presbyterians, Unitarians, Baptists, whatever we are, we're human beings beneath it all, and a part of nature, and living on this really, at least from our perspective, fragile bubble floating through space. I say from our perspective because, of course, if we make life inhospitable for ourselves or for the next generation or for some generations to come, the planet will go on cycling through space. There will still be a rock here orbiting the sun, but it won't be amenable to our form of life. And I think that's the issue that Wilson was trying to awaken those pastors and all of his readers to, is the idea that, wherever you're coming from, spiritually, in terms of religion or your irreligion, philosophy, wherever you're coming from, here you are on this planet. The planet is in crisis. We've contributed to that crisis, and it's at least some would say it's not too late to reverse the worst threats that are looming. It's probably too late to go back to a time when summers at this latitude were perfectly comfortable for most of us.
We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. This is MTSU on the Record.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about environmental ethics, a class being taught this fall by Dr. Phil Oliver, Professor of Philosophy at MTSU. What about capitalism as a philosophy? Why should we necessarily think that environmentalism and capitalism need be incompatible with one another? After all, is it not in the capitalist best interest, selfish, amoral interest though it may be, to preserve resources specifically because the capitalist is going to need them later in order to continue to prosper, to continue right. to have good business, and is going to be dependent upon water, air, not only the basics, but the building blocks from which he makes his product or provides his service. I mean, why does that not filter into the corporate thinking process?
That's right. This is the question about long versus short-term thinking, about whether your goal is to impress the stockholders at the next annual meeting, or whether you're really thinking long-term about preserving markets, not just serving them in the short term. And this is why the second text we're going to read in the course is called The Bridge at the End of the World. It's by a guy named Gus Speth, and he's making the case that capitalism in its present form has not been serving us well, precisely because of the short-term thinking that it seems to reinforce and to encourage. But I would certainly agree that there's no inherent incompatibility in the idea that smart capitalists would recognize that markets have to be sustained, just as the other conditions of life have to be sustained in order for humans to live well and flourish.
Philosophically, how hard is it for we human beings to really care about what happens to other generations down the road, future generations, beyond our own children and grandchildren? Can we really be that altruistic?
That's an open question. It's one of my pet favorite subjects that I bring up almost every semester in almost all my classes, is how much of the future are you capable of caring about? And do you think, college students, I recall from my own experience, are very oriented towards the immediate goal of getting through the class, getting through the semester, eventually getting that degree and getting on into the workforce and getting on with their lives. And that's perfectly understandable. The definition of success that we have fostered and encouraged among students in particular is one that doesn't see the value of looking down the road very far. And yet, that's what environmentalism really requires. I mean, prudent, self-interested, but also benevolent environmentalism requires us to think beyond our own lifetimes and to think long-term. And how long-term is psychologically possible for most of us is probably a variable matter. And some of us find it natural to think in terms of a long, long period before we got here and a long period after we're gone. That is, not we as humans, but we, in our families and in the lives that we know and are building. Stuart Brand, I'm not using any of his texts this time, but I have used him in the past in environmental ethics and in other courses. Stuart Brand is the guy who gave us the Whole Earth Catalog, and that idea was born from the notion that we need to think long term. We need to look at the whole planet and think about what's in its long term best interest and how we can best do our part, custodially speaking, to make sure that it remains, a place where people somewhat like ourselves can live well in the future.
Do you differentiate between conservationism and environmentalism, or do you perceive it as all part of the same picture?
I think it is all part of the same picture. If you go back, a few decades to people like Aldo Leopold, I don't suppose there was any distinction between those terms, although the more common term that you would hear was conservationism. And really, so much about what we associate with modern-day environmentalism, as we were saying earlier, is new. Just within, within the last couple of decades, I mean, we've only recently really figured out, and for some people this will be controversial, but I think not for most people who've studied the science, we've only recently figured out that we are, in fact, contributing to a rising temperature of the planet. That this is not in our best interests, may not be in the best interest of other life forms on the planet. This so-called anthropogenic global warming that we hear about, that we've been experiencing, it seems. And so that's, that aspect of the whole environmental issue, our awareness of environmentalism, is new and is still being sort of registered by a lot of people who would like to deny it for whatever reason. And I don't want to say that there aren't any honest people of conscience who are skeptical. There are genuine skeptics, but I'm really targeting, when I criticize them, I'm targeting those who have adopted a position, sort of put blinders on because it's in their financial interests to do so.
here's an environmental quandary for you. You know, the fish and game rangers will say that it's good for people to hunt and fish because we have to manage populations of certain species, deer, bear, whatever. And yet, how does that square with the ethicality of someone who is not only pro-environmentalism and pro-conservation, but is also pro-animal rights?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you reconcile those two competing factors?
Right. There are some interesting issues that arise when we're, for instance, thinking with people like Peter Singer, Animal Liberation, who want to say that the human interest should enjoy no ethical privilege. Right? There's no reason to privilege ourselves above other species. I suppose from my own perspective, I've said for a long time, and I haven't yet found reason to withdraw this statement, I consider myself kind of a speciesist in this regard. I do think that the human interest has to be served, that it matters, the fact we're trying to create and sustain a world for our grandchildren matters to us, and that we shouldn't put them equally on the scale with snail darters and so on. And yet I don't want to be dismissive of the concern that people have on behalf of animal rights in their own regard, but also because they're part of an ecosystem and that there are interrelationships throughout nature, that once you start tinkering with those, it's as though you'd pulled out a thread and you don't know how the garment is going to unweave. Right? And it's what I'd say about animal rights is that they certainly, certainly in an ethics course, whether it's called environmental ethics or whatever, animal rights have to be taken into account. But I'm not one of those radical greens who would say that we need to sort of withdraw ourselves from the scene that the human species has been a pox on the planet, and the sooner we're gone, the better. No, I think the human interest in survival is important. We need to take care that there will be humans or post-humans or beings to inherit our mantle, that we don't make it impossible for them to do so.
Is Greenpeace too radical in your view, or do you appreciate where they're coming from?
Well, I'm still trying to appreciate them. And one of the things that I read over the summer to prepare for this course, I went back to Edward Abbey and his monkey wrench gang and talk about sort of sabotaging dams and so forth, in the name of green. Green consciousness.
They do seem to be taking a page out of the Yippie playbook of pulling stunts and tricks in order to get their point across.
Which in a political context can certainly backfire and not be in the best interest of the cause they're trying to serve. And yet I understand the frustration that some of those green radicals express in a time when it seems that the writing is on the wall and there are those who simply won't see it. They're trying to get our attention. I do understand that. But I'm a pragmatist, too, and I want us to succeed in our efforts to save the environment and not to so polarize or more polarize the issue that it's impossible for us to recognize our common interest across political, religious, and other boundaries and do something about this.
There was one environmental group. It was not Greenpeace who put large metal stakes in logs, and when the lumbermen would try to cut down the trees,
right,
it would not only damage their logs, but also lumbermen would end up getting hurt, and I can't countenance that under any semblance of the word ethics.
No. And actually, neither did Edward Abbey, by the way. He followed up the Monkey Wrench Gang, or maybe actually included this in the preface. I've forgotten where this was, that he said that anybody who takes any of this literally will be shot. That was a joke. It doesn't sound like a great joke, but in any case, I'm sure that Edward Abbey had his fans who did take it very seriously, the notion that whatever you need to do in order to get the loggers to stop logging or whatever is justified by the end. I don't tend to think that ends justify means at all.
Time for another short break. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is MTSU on the Record.
The Middle East Center at MTSU seeks to promote greater understanding of the politics, history, and culture of this vitally important region of the world. Its mission includes the promotion of outreach programs and faculty research. The center sponsors lectures by Middle East experts and scholarly exchanges. We're especially pleased to offer a new interdisciplinary minor in Middle East Studies with courses in Arabic and Hebrew. This is Dr. Alan Hibbard, Center Director.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about environmental ethics with Dr. Phil Oliver, who will teach this course in the fall. He's a professor of philosophy at MTSU. Is it ethical for us to be convenient environmentalist, by which I say some of us won't recycle unless and until there is convenient governmentally sponsored curbside recycling, and then we will separate our bottles and our cans and our paper and all of that sort of thing. We will argue, well, you know, I want to be green, but I'm not going to turn my life upside down in order to make it happen. I've got other things going on. I've got to take care of the kids. I got to work. I got to do this. I got to do that. Yada, yada, yada. Is it unethical to be a convenient environmentalist?
Well, unethical is a strong condemnation. I would say that it is self-serving. And you know, if we've really internalized this this understanding of ourselves as part of nature and part of a fragile ecosystem, then we will be willing to inconvenience ourselves for the sake of doing what we think will make a positive contribution to rectifying these problems. On the other hand, you know, we as a society, we need our policymakers to do whatever they can to reward people who inconvenience themselves voluntarily on behalf of the planet. We need to make that easy and not hard. The trouble we're having is we're not at least in our political discourse, we're not agreeing on what the right thing is.
This is a presidential election year. Does green work as a political buzzword?
It appears that that politicians in both parties want to stand as far back from this issue as they can. And I think it's really sad that I heard some political commentator saying recently that he would be very surprised, shocked even, if this issue were pushed by either party in this election. This issue being, you know, the survival of our species on this planet. What an amazing commentary that is, that that our politics doesn't want to touch, quote, controversial issues.
There will be three presidential debates and one vice presidential debate this election year. Do you expect to hear any of the journalists pose an environmental question?
Well, that's another concern. It would be great to have more environmentalists involved in the political process and in the electoral process, and sort of insisting that our leaders address this issue. And I don't want to be cynical and say, no, I don't expect it, but and I'll be watching and hoping. You know, it does seem that our elections turn more on trivia than they do on matters that are really important.
Is your class full this fall?
It is not full. There's room. I hope people will join us.
Send an email to Dr. Phil Oliver at poliver@mtsu.edu if you want to know more about the fall 2012 Environmental Ethics Philosophy course. Phil, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you so much.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.